A Week in the Country. On a sunny morning of 1962 in Cleveland, Ohio, it was raining in Krasnoy, and the streets between gray walls were full of men. "It's raining down my neck in here," Kazimir complained, but his friend in the adjoining stall of the street corner WC did not hear him because he was also talking. "Historical necessity is a solecism. What is history except what had to happen? But you can't extend that. What happens next? God knows." Kazimir followed him out, still buttoning his trousers, and looked at the small boy looking at the 9-foot-long black coffin leaning against the WC.
"What's in it?" the boy asked.
"My great-aunt's body," Kazimir explained. He picked up the coffin, hurried on with Stefan Fabre through the rain. Note: this Stefan is the grandson of the Stefan Fabre in Brothers and Sisters. He will reappear 27 years later in Unlocking the Air, page 543 in this volume, as an example of the way the Orsinian tales are linked by theme, image, and ongoing cultural and historical forces more than by simple chronology. End note.
"A farce. Determinism's a farce. Anything to avoid awe. Show me a seed," Stefan Fabre said, stopping and pointing at Kazimir. "Yes, I can tell you what it is. It's an apple seed. But can I tell you that an apple tree will grow from it? No. Because there's no freedom. We think there's a law, but there is no law. There's growth and death, delight and terror, an abyss. The rest we invent. We're going to miss the train."
They jostled on up Tiponti Street. The rain fell harder. Stefan Fabre strode, swinging his briefcase, his mouth firmly closed, his white face shining wet.
"Why didn't you take up the piccolo? Give me that a while," he said as Kazimir tangled with an office worker running for a bus.
"Science bearing the burden of art," Kazimir said. "Heavy, isn't it?" as his friend hoisted the case and lugged it on, frowning and, by the time they reached West Station, gasping. On the platform in rain and steam, they ran as others ran, heard whistles shriek and urgent Sanskrit blare from loudspeakers, and lurched exhausted into the first car. The compartments were all empty. It was the other train that was pulling out, jammed, a suburban train. Theirs sat still for 10 minutes.
"Nobody on this train but us?" Stefan Fabre asked, morose, standing at the window.
Then with one high peep, the walls slid away. Raindrops shook and merged on the pane. Tracks interwove on a viaduct. The two young men stared into bedroom windows and at brick walls painted with enormous letters. Abruptly, nothing was left in the rain-dark evening sliding backwards to the east, but a line of hills, black against a colorless, clearing sky.
"The country," Stefan Fabre said.
He got out a biochemical journal from amongst socks and undershirts in his briefcase, put on dark-rimmed glasses, read. Kazimir pushed back wet hair that had fallen all over his forehead, read the sign on the windowsill that said, "Do not lean out," stared at the shaking walls and the rain shuddering on the window, dozed. He dreamed that walls were falling down around him. He woke scared as they pulled out of Okots. His friend sat looking out the window, white-faced and black-haired, confirming the isolation and disaster of Kazimir's dream.
"Can't see anything," he said. "Night. Country's the only place where they have night left."
He stared through the reflection of his own face into the night that filled his eyes with blessed darkness. "So here we are on a train going to Eisenar," Kazimir said. "But we don't know that it's going to Eisenar. It might go to Peking."
"It might derail and we'll all be killed. And if we do come to Eisenar, what's Eisenar? Mere hearsay."
"That's morbid," Kazimir said, glimpsing again the walls collapsing.
"No, exhilarating,"
his friend answered.
"Takes a lot of work to hold the world together, when you look at it that way. But it's worthwhile, building up cities, holding up the roofs by an act of fidelity. not faith, fidelity.
He gazed out the window through his reflected eyes. Casimir shared a bar of mud-like chocolate with him. They came to Eisenar. Rain fell in the gold-paved, ill-lit streets, while the autobus to Vermare and Prevne waited for its passengers in South Square, under dripping sycamores. The case rode in the back seat. A chicken with a string round its neck scratched the aisle for grain. A bushy-haired woman held the other end of the string. A drunk farm worker talked loudly to the driver as the bus groaned out of Eisenar southward into the country night, the same night, the blessed darkness.
So I says to him, I says, "You don't know what'll happen tomorrow."
"Listen," said Casimir, "if the universe is infinite, does that mean that everything that could possibly happen is happening somewhere at some time?"
"Saturday," he says, "Saturday."
"I don't know. It would. But we don't know what's possible. Thank God. If we did, I'd shoot myself, eh?"
"Come back Saturday," he says. And I says, "Saturday be damned," I says.
In Vermare, rain fell on the ruins of the Tower Keep, and the drunk got off, leaving silence behind him. Stefan Fabre looked glum, said he had a sore throat, and fell into a quick, weary sleep. His head jiggled to the ruts and bumps of the foothill road as the bus ran westward, clearing a tunnel through solid black with its headlights. A tree, a great oak, bent down suddenly to shelter it. The doors opened, admitting clean air, flashlights, boots, and caps. Brushing back his fair hair, Casimir said softly, "Always happens. Only 6 miles from the border here." They felt in their breast pockets, handed over.
"Fabre Stefan, domicile 136 Tome Street, Krasnoy, student, MR 64100282A. Aujeskar Casimir, domicile 4 Sorden Street, Krasnoy, student, MR 80104944A. Where are you going?"
"Prevne."
"Both of you? Business?"
"Vacation. A week in the country."
"What's that?"
"A base vial case."
"What's in it?"
"A base vial?"
It was stood up, opened, closed again, lugged out, laid on the ground, opened again, and the huge vial stood fragile and magnificent among flashlights over the mud, boots, belt buckles, caps.
"Keep it off the ground,"
Casimir said in a sharp voice, and Stefan pushed in front of him. They fingered it, shook it.
"Here, Kazi, does this unscrew?"
"No, there's no way to take it apart."
The fat one slapped the great shining curve of wood, saying something about his wife, so that Stefan laughed, but the vial tilted in another's hands. A tuning peg squawked, and on the patter of rain and mutter of the bus engine idling, a booming twang uncurled, broken off short like the vial string. Stefan took hold of Casimir's arm. After the bus had started again, they sat side by side in the warm, stinking darkness. Casimir said,
"Sorry, Stefan."
"Thanks.
Can you fix it?"
"Yes. Just the peg snapped. I can fix it."
"Damn sore throat."
Stefan rubbed his head and left his hands over his eyes.
"Taking cold. Damn rain."
"We're near Prevne now."
In Prevne, very fine rain drifted down one street between two street lamps. Behind the roofs, something loomed. Treetops? Hills? No one met them, since Casimir had forgotten to write which night they were coming. Returning from the one public telephone, he joined Stefan and the base vial case at the table of the post-telephone bar.
"Father has the car out on a call. We can walk or wait here. Sorry."
His long, fair face was discouraged, contrite.
"It's a couple of miles."
They set off. They walked in silence up a dirt road in rain and darkness between fields. The air smelt of wet earth. Casimir began to whistle, but the rain wet his lips. He stopped. It was so dark that they walked slowly, not able to see where each step took them, whether the road was rough or plain. It was so still that they heard the multitudinous whisper of the rain on fields to left and right.
They were climbing. The hill loomed ahead of them, solider darkness. Stefan stopped to turn up his wet coat collar, and because he was dizzy. As he went forward again in the chill, whispering country silence, he heard a soft, clear sound, a girl laughing behind the hill. Lights sprang up at the hill crest, sparkling, waving.
"What's that?"
he said, stopping unnerved in the broken dark. A child shouted,
"There they are!"
The lights above them danced and descended. They were encircled by lanterns, flashlights, voices calling, faces and arms lit by flashes and vanishing again into night. Clearly, once more, right at his side, the sweet laugh rang out.
"Father didn't come back, and you didn't come, so we all came to meet you."
"Did you bring your friend? Where is he?"
"Hello, Kazi."
Kazimir's fair head bent to another in the gleam of a lantern.
"Where's your fiddle? Didn't you bring it? It's been raining like this all week."
"Left it with Mr. Prospayats at the post telephone."
"Let's go on and get it. It's lovely walking." "I'm Bendika. Are you Stefan?"
She laughed as they sought each other's hands to shake in darkness. She turned her lantern round and was dark-haired, as tall as her brother, the only one of them he saw clearly before they all went back down the road talking, laughing, flashing light beams over the road and roadside weeds, or up into the rain-thick air. He saw them all for a moment in the bar as Kazimir got his bull fiddle. Two boys, a man, tall Bendika, the young blonde one who had kissed Kazimir, another still younger. All of them he saw all at once, and then they were off up the road again, and he must wonder which of the three girls, or was it four, had laughed before they met. The chill rain picked at his hot face. Beside him, beaming a flashlight so they could see the road, the man said,
"I'm Joachim Brett."
"Enzymes,"
Stefan replied hoarsely.
"Yes, what's your field?"
"Molecular genetics."
"No, too good. You work with Metor, then? Catch me up, will you? Do you see the American journals?"
They talked helices for half a mile, Brett voluble, Stefan laconic, as he was still dizzy and still listened for the laugh. But all of them laughed. He could not be sure. Note. The date this story is set, 1962, is the year Francis Crick, James D. Watson, and Maurice Wilkins received the Nobel Prize for their discovery of the helical form of DNA molecules, a discovery first announced by Watson and Crick in the journal Nature in 1953. Rosalind Franklin, whose X-ray images of DNA played a key role in the discovery of its structure, was not eligible for the prize because of her death in 1958. End note. They all fell silent a moment. Only the two boys ran far ahead, calling.
"There's the house,"
tall Bendika said beside him, pointing to a yellow gleam.
"Still with us, Stefan?"
Kazimir called from somewhere in the dark. He growled yes, resenting the silly good cheer, the running and calling and laughing, the enthusiastic, jerky Brett, the yellow windows that to all of them were home, but to him not. Inside the house they shed wet coats, spread, multiplied, regathered around a table in a high dark room shot through with noise and lamplight for coffee and coffee cake borne in by Kazimir's mother. She walked hurried and tranquil under a gray and dark brown coronet of braids. Base vial-shaped, mother of seven, she merged Stefan with all the other young people whom she distinguished one from another only by name. They were named Valeria, Bendika, Antoni, Bruna, Kazimir, Joachim, Paul. They joked and chattered. The little dark girl screamed with laughter. Kazimir's fair hair fell over his eyes. The two boys of 11 squabbled. The gaunt, smiling man sat with a guitar and presently played, his face beaked like a crow's over the instrument. His right hand plucking the strings was slightly crippled or deformed. They sang, all but Stefan, who did not know the songs, had a sore throat, would not sing, sat rancorous amid the singers. Dr. Augeskar came in. He shook Kazimir's hand, welcoming and defacing him, a tall king with a slender and unlikely air.
"Where's your friend? Sorry I couldn't meet you. Had an emergency up the road. Appendectomy on the dining table. Like carving the Christmas goose. Get to bed, Antoni. Dandika, get me a glass. Joachim? You, Fabre?
He poured out red wine and sat down with them at the great round table. They sang again. Aujeskar suggested the songs. His voice led the others. He filled the room. The fair daughter flirted with him. The little dark one screeched with laughter. Bendika teased Kazimir. Brett sang a love song in Swedish. It was only 11 o'clock. Dr. Aujeskar had gray eyes, clear under blonde brows. Stefan met their stare.
You've got a cold?
Yes.
Then go to bed. Diana, where does Fabre sleep?
Kazimir jumped up, contrite, led Stefan upstairs and through corridors and rooms, all smelling of hay and rain.
When's breakfast?
Oh, any time.
For Kazimir never knew the time of any event.
Good night, Stefan.
But it was a bad night, miserable, and all through it Brett's crippled hand snapped off one great coiling string after another with a booming twang, while he explained,
"This is how you go after them the latest," grinning.
In the morning, Stefan could not get up. Sunlit walls leaned inward over the bed, and the sky came stretching in the windows, a huge blue balloon. He lay there. He hid his pin-stiff, aching black hair under his hands and moaned. The tall, golden-gray man came in and said to him with perfect certainty,
"My boy, you're sick."
It was balm. Sick. He was sick. The walls and sky were all right.
"A very respectable fever you're running,"
said the doctor, and Stefan smiled, near tears, feeling himself respectable, lapped in the broad, indifferent tenderness of the big man who was kingly, certain, uncaring as sunlight in the sky. But in the forests and caves and small crowded rooms of his fever, no sunlight came, and after a time, no water. The house stood quiet in the September sunlight and dark. That night, Mrs. Aujeskar, yarn, needle, sock, poised one moment in her hands, lifted her braid-crowned head, listening as she had listened years ago to her first son, Kazimir, crying out in sleep in his crib upstairs.
"Poor child," she whispered.
And Bruna raised her fair head listening too, for the first time, hearing the solitary cry from the forests where she had never been. The house stood still around them. On the second day, the boys played outdoors till rain fell and night fell. Kazimir stood in the kitchen, sawing on his bull fiddle, his face by the shining neck of the instrument quiet and closed, keeping right on when others came in to perch on stools and lean against the sink and talk, for after all there were 7 young people there on vacation. They could not stay silent. But under their voices the deep, weak, singing voice of Kazimir's fiddle went on wordless, like a cry from the depths of the forest, so that Bruna suddenly passed patience and dependence, solitary, not the third daughter and fourth child, and one of the young people, slipped away and went upstairs to see what it was like, this grave sickness, this mortality. It was not like anything. The young man slept. His face was white, his hair black on white linen, clear as printed words, but in a foreign language. She came down and told her mother she had looked in. He was sleeping quietly. True enough, but not the truth. What she had confirmed up there was that she was now ready to learn the way through the forest. She had come of age, and was now capable of dying. He was her guide, the young man who had come in out of the rain with a case of pneumonia. On the afternoon of the fifth day, she went up to his room again. He was lying there getting well, weak and content, thinking about a morning 10 years ago when he had walked out with his father and grandfather past the quarries, an April morning on a dry plain awash with sunlight and blue flowers. After they had passed the Chorin Company quarries, they suddenly began to talk politics, and he understood that they had come out of town onto the empty plain in order to say things aloud, in order to let him hear what his father said.
"There'll always be enough ants to fill up all the ant hills. Worker ants, army ants."
and the grandfather, the dry, bitter, fitful man, in his 70s, angrier and gentler than his son, vulnerable as his 13-year-old grandson.
"Get out, Costa! Why don't you get out?"
That was only a taunt. None of them would run away, or get away. A man, he walked with men across a barren plain, blue with flowers in brief April. They shared with him their anger, their barren, helpless obduracy, and the brief blue fire of their anger. Talking aloud under the open sky, they gave him the key to the House of Manhood, the prison where they lived and he would live. But they had known other houses. He had not. Once his grandfather, Stefan Fabre, put his hand on young Stefan's shoulder while he spoke.
"What would we do with freedom if we had it, Costa? What has the West done with it, eaten it, put it in its belly? A great, wondrous belly, that's the West, with a wise head on top of it, a man's head, with a man's mind and eyes. But the rest, all belly. He can't walk anymore. He sits at table eating, eating, thinking up machines to bring him more food, more food. Throwing food to the black and yellow rats under the table so they won't gnaw down the walls around him. There he sits, and here we are, with nothing in our bellies but air, air and cancer, air and rage. We can still walk, so we're yoked, yoked to the foreign plow. When we smell food, we bray and kick. Are we men, though, Costa? I doubt it."
All the time his hand lay on the boy's shoulder, tender, almost deferent, because the boy had never seen his inheritance at all, but had been born in jail, where nothing is any good, no anger, understanding, or pride. Nothing is any good except obduracy, except fidelity. "Those remain," said the weight of the old man's hand on his shoulder. So when a blonde girl came into his room where he lay weak and content, he looked at her from that sun-washed, barren April plain with trust and welcome, it being irrelevant to this moment that his grandfather had died in a deportation train, and his father had been shot along with 42 other men on the plain outside town in the reprisals of 1956. Note: this is confirmation that the Hungarian-style uprising anticipated in The Road East has occurred, and, predictably, has been forcibly repressed by the Soviets. End note.
"How do you feel?"
she said, and he said, "Fine."
"Can I bring you anything?"
He shook his head, the same black and white head she had seen clear and unintelligible as Greek words on a white page, but now his eyes were open and he spoke her language. It was the same voice that had called faintly from the black woods of Fever, the neighborhood of death, a few nights ago, which now said,
"I can't remember your name."
He was very nice. He was a nice fellow, this Stefan Fabre, embarrassed by lying there sick, glad to see her.
"I'm Bruna. I come next after Kazi. Would you like some books? Are you getting bored yet?"
"Bored? No. You don't know how good it is to lie here doing nothing. I've never done that. Your parents are so kind, and this big house and the fields outside there.
I lie here thinking, Jesus, is this me?
In all this peace, in all this space, in a room to myself doing nothing."
She laughed, by which he knew her, the one who had laughed in rain and darkness before lights broke over the hill. Her fair hair was parted in the middle and waved on each side down nearly to the light, thick eyebrows. Her eyes were an indeterminate color, unclear gray-brown or gray. He heard it now outdoors, in daylight, the tender and exultant laugh.
"Oh, you beauty, you fine, proud filly foal, never broken to harness, you scared and restive, gentle girl laughing."
Wanting to keep her, he asked,
"Have you always lived here?"
And she said,
"Yes, summers,"
glancing at him from her indeterminate, shining eyes in the shadow of fair hair.
"Where did you grow up?"
"In Svaroy Kampe, up north."
"Your family's still there?"
"My sister lives there."
She still asked about families. She must be very innocent, more elusive and intact even than Kazimir, who placed his reality beyond the touch of any hands or asking of identity. Still, to keep her with him, he said, "I lie here thinking. I've thought more already today than in the last 3 years."
"What do you think of?"
"Of the Hungarian nobleman. Do you know that story? The one that was taken prisoner by the Turks and sold as a slave. It was the 16th century. Well, a Turk bought him and yoked him to a plow like an ox, and he plowed the fields driven by a whip. His family finally managed to buy him back, and he went home and got his sword and went back to the battlefields. And there he took prisoner the Turk that had bought him, owned him, took the Turk back to his manor, took the chains off him, had him brought outside. And the poor Turk looked around for the impaling stake, you know, or the pitch they'd rub on him and set fire to, or the dogs, or at least the whip. But there was nothing. Only the Hungarian, the man he'd bought and sold. And the Hungarian said, 'Go on back home.'
Did he go?
No. He stayed and turned Christian. But that's not why I think of it."
"Why do you?"
"I'd like to be a nobleman," Stefan Fabre said, grinning. He was a tough, hard fellow, lying there nearly defeated, but not defeated. He grinned. His eyes had a black flicker to them. At 25, he had no innocence, no confidence, no hope at all of profit. The lack of that was the black flicker, the coldness in his eyes. Yet he lay there, taking what came, a small man but hard, possessing weight, a man of substance. The girl looked at his strong, blunt hands on the blanket and then up at the sunlit windows, thinking of his being a nobleman, thinking of the one fact she knew of him from Kazimir, who seldom mentioned facts, that he shared a tenement room in Krasnoy with 5 other students. 3 beds were all they could fit into it. The room, with 3 high windows, curtains pulled back, hummed with the silence of September afternoon in the country. A boy's voice rang out from fields far away.
"Not much chance of it these days," she said in a dull, soft voice,
looking down, meaning nothing, for once wholly cast down, tired, without tenderness or exultation. He would get well, would go back a week late to the city, to the 3 bedsteads and 5 roommates, shoes on the floor and rust and hairs in the washbasin, classrooms, laboratories. After that, employment as an inspector of sanitation on state farms in the north and northeast, a 2-room flat in state housing on the outskirts of a town near the state foundries, a black-haired wife who taught the 3rd grade from state-approved textbooks, 1 child, 2 legal abortions, and the hydrogen bomb. Oh, was there no way out? No way?
"Are you very clever?"
"I'm very good at my work."
"It's science, isn't it?"
"Biology. Research." Then the laboratories would persist. The flat became perhaps a 4-room flat in the Krasnoy suburbs. 2 children. No abortions. 2-week vacations in summer in the mountains. Then the hydrogen bomb. Or no hydrogen bomb. It made no difference.
"What do you research on?"
"Certain molecules. The molecular structure of life." That was strange. The structure of life. Of course, he was talking down to her. Things are not briefly described, her father had said, when one is talking of life. So he was good at finding out the molecular structure of life, this fellow whose wordless cry she had heard faintly from congested lungs, from the dark neighborhood and approaches of his death. He had called out and,
"Poor child,"
her mother had whispered. But it was she who had answered, had followed him. And now he brought her back to life.
"Ah,"
she said, still not lifting her head,
"I don't understand all that. I'm stupid."
"Why did they name you Bruna when you're blonde?"
She looked up, startled, laughed.
"I was bald till I was 10 months old.
She looked at him, seeing him again, and the future be damned, since all possible futures ever envisaged are rusty sinks, 2-week vacations, and bombs, or collective fraternity, or harps and huris, endlessly, sordidly dreary, all delight being in the present and its past, all truth, too, and all fidelity in the word, the flesh, the present moment. For the future, however you look at it, contains only 1 sure thing, and that is death. But the moment is unpredictable,
There is simply no telling what will happen. Casimir came in with a bunch of red and blue flowers and said, Mother wants to know if you'd like milk toast for supper.
Oat bread, oat bread,
Bruna sang, arranging the cornflowers and poppies in Stefan's water glass. They ate oats three times a day here, some poultry, turnips, potatoes. The little brother Antoni raised lettuce, the mother cooked, the daughters swept the big house. There was no wheat flour, no beef, no milk, no housemaid, not anymore, not since before Bruna was born. They camped here in their big old country house. They lived like gypsies, said the mother. A professor's daughter born in the middle class, nurtured and married in the middle class, giving up order, plenty, and leisure without complaint, but not giving up the least scruple of the discriminations she had been privileged to learn. So Casimir, for all his gentleness, could still hold himself untouched. So Bruna still thought of herself as coming next after Casimir, and asked about one's family. So Stefan knew himself here in a fortress, in a family, at home. He and Casimir and Bruna were laughing aloud together when the father came in. Out, Dr. Augescar said, standing heroic and absolute in the doorway. The Sun King, or a solar myth. His son and daughter, laughing and signaling childlike to Stefan behind his back, went out.
Enough is enough, Augescar said, ausculting,
and Stefan lay guilty, smiling, childlike. The seventh day, when Stefan and Casimir should have taken bus and train back to Krasnoy, where the university was now open, was hot. Warm darkness followed, windows open, the whole house open to choruses of frogs by the river, choruses of crickets in the furrows, a southwest wind bearing odors of the forest over dry autumn hills. Between the curtains billowing and going slack burned six stars, so bright in the dry, dark sky that they might set fire to the curtains. Bruna sat on the floor by Stefan's bed. Casimir lay like a huge wheat stalk across the foot of it. Bendika, whose husband was in Krasnoy, nursed her five-month-old firstborn in a chair by the empty fireplace. Joachim Brett sat on the windowsill, his shirt sleeves rolled up so that the bluish figures OA46992 were visible on his lean arm, playing his guitar to accompany an English lute song. Note: Brett is evidently a former prisoner at Auschwitz and bears the distinctive tattooed identification number. End note. Yet be just and constant still, love may beget a wonder, not unlike a summer's frost or winter's fatal thunder. He that holds his sweetheart dear until his day of dying lives of all that ever lived most worthy the envying. Note: poem and musical setting by English poet Thomas Campion, 1567-1620, from Fourth Book of Airs, circa 1617. Its opening lines are, Silly boy, 'tis full moon, yet thy night as day shines clearly. Had thy youth but wit to fear, thou couldst not love so dearly. End note. Then, since he liked to sing praise and blame of love in all the languages he knew, and did not know, he began to strum out Plaisir d'amour, but came to grief on the shift of key while the baby was sat up to belch loudly, causing merriment. Note: Plaisir d'amour, classical French love song, 1784, by Jean-Paul Egide Martigny, 1741-1816, with lyrics from a poem by Jean-Pierre Clarisse de Florion, 1755-1794. Like Campion's, this is an ominous look at love. The pleasure of love lasts only a moment. The grief of love lasts a lifetime. Martigny's tune was adapted into the popular song Can't Help Falling in Love with You, recorded by Elvis Presley in 1961. End note. The baby was flung aloft by Casimir while Bendika protested softly, He's full, Kazi, he'll spill.
I am your uncle. I am Uncle Casimir. My pockets are full of peppermints and papal indulgences. Look at me, whelp. You don't dare vomit on your uncle. You don't dare. Go vomit on your aunt.
The baby stared unwinking at Bruna and waved its hands. Its fat, silky belly showed between shirt and diaper. The girl returned its gaze as silently, as steadily.
"Who are you?" said the baby.
"Who are you?" said the maiden, without words, in wonder, while Stefan watched and faint chords in A sobbed joyously on Brett's guitar between the lighted room and the dark, dry night of autumn. The tall young mother carried the baby off to bed. Kazimir turned off the light. Now the autumn night was in the room, and their voices spoke among the choruses of crickets and frogs on the fields by the streams.
"It was clever of you to get sick, Stefan," said Kazimir, lying again across the foot of the bed, long arms white in the dusk. "Stay sick, and we can stay here all winter."
"All year? For years? Did you get your fiddle fixed?"
"Oh, yes. Been practicing the Schubert. Pa, pa, paum, pa."
"When's the concert?"
"Sometime in October. Plenty of time. Paum, paum. Swim, swim, little trout."
Note. The piece Kazimir is practicing is the Trout Quintet, or the Piano Quintet in A Major, 1819, by Franz Schubert, 1797 to 1828. Introduced in this story, Schubert dominates the next En de Musique, page 480. The trout, named for its musical quotation of an earlier song by Schubert called Die Forelle, or The Trout, is unusual within the chamber repertoire in including a bass viol along with the more standard piano, violin, viola, and cello. Kazimir has deliberately chosen a rarely featured instrument. The Dvorak cello concerto raises that instrument to the virtuoso level more often enjoyed by violinists, and opted for a career playing ensembles rather than solos. End note.
Ah!
The long white arms sawed vaguely a vial of dusk.
"Why did you choose the bass vial, Kazimir?"
asked Brett's voice among frogs and crickets, across marsh bottoms and furrows, from the windowsill.
"Because he's shy," said Bruna's voice, like a country wind.
"Because he's an enemy of the feasible," said Stefan's dark, dry voice.
Silence.
"Because I showed extraordinary promise as a student of the cello," said Kazimir's voice, "and so I was forced to consider, did I want to perform the Dvorak concerto to cheering audiences and win a People's Artist Award, or did I not?"
Note. Cello Concerto in B Minor, Opus 104, 1894-95, the last solo concerto written by Czech composer Antonín Dvořák, 1841-1904, and his only completed concerto for cello. End note.
"I chose to be a low buzz in the background. Paum, pa-paum. And when I die, I want you to put my corpse in the fiddle case and ship it rapid express deep freeze to Pablo Casals with a label saying, 'Corpse of Great Central European Cellist.'"
Note. Pau Casals y Di Fio, 1876-1973, known as Pablo Casals, preeminent cellist and conductor from Spain. End note. The hot wind blew through the dark. Kazimir was done. Bruna and Stefan were ready to pass on, but Joachim Brett was not able to. He spoke of a man who had been helping people get across the border. Here in the Southwest, rumors of him were thick now. A young man, Brett said, who had been jailed, had escaped, got to England, and come back, set up an escape route, got over 100 people out in 10 months, and only now had been spotted and was being hunted by the secret police.
"Quixotic? Traitorous? Heroic?" Brett asked.
"He's hiding in the attic now," Kazimir said, and Stefan added,
"Sick of milk toast."
They evaded and would not judge. Betrayal and fidelity were immediate to them, could not be weighed any more than a pound of flesh, their own flesh. Only Brett, who had been born outside prison, was excited, insistent. Prevna was crawling with agents, he went. Even if you went to buy a newspaper, your identification was checked.
Easier to have it tattooed on, like you, said Kazimir.
Move your foot, Stefan.
Move your fat rump, then.
Oh, mine are German numbers, out of date. A few more wars and I'll run out of skin.
Shed it, then, like a snake.
No, they go right down to the bone.
Shed your bones, then, Stefan said. Be a jellyfish. Be an amoeba. When they pin me down, I butt off. Two little spineless Stefans, where they thought they had one MR64100282A. 4 of them. 8, 16, 32, 64, 128. I would entirely cover the surface of the globe were it not for my natural enemies.
The bed shook. Bruna laughed in darkness.
Play the English song again, Joachim, she said.
Yet be just and constant still, love may beget a wonder.
Stefan, she said in the afternoon light of the 14th day, as she sat and he lay with his head on her lap, on a green bank above the river marshes south of the house.
He opened his eyes.
Must we go?
No.
He closed his eyes again, saying,
Bruna.
He sat up and sat beside her, staring at her.
Bruna, oh God, I wish you weren't a virgin.
She laughed and watched him, wary, curious, defenseless.
If only, here now, I've got to go away day after tomorrow.
But not right under the kitchen windows, she said tenderly.
The house stood 30 yards from them. He collapsed by her, burying his head in the angle of her arm, against her side, his lips on the very soft skin of her forearm. She stroked his hair and the nape of his neck.
Can we get married? Do you want to get married?
Yes, I want to marry you, Stefan.
He lay still a while longer, then sat up again, slowly this time, and looked across the reeds and choked sunlit river to the hills and the mountains behind them.
I'll have my degree next year.
I'll have my teaching certificate in a year and a half.
They were silent a while.
I could quit school and work. We'll have to apply for a place.
The walls of the one rented room facing a courtyard, strung with sooty washing, rose up around them, indestructible.
All right, he said. Only I hate to waste this.
He looked from the sunlit water up to the mountains. The warm wind of evening blew past them.
All right. But, Bruna, do you understand?
That all this is new to me, that I have never waked before at dawn in a high-windowed room and lain hearing the perfect silence, never walked out over fields in a bright October morning, never sat down at table with fair laughing brothers and sisters, never spoken in early evening by a river with a girl who loved me, that I have known that order, peace, and tenderness must exist, but I never hoped even to witness them, let alone possess them. And day after tomorrow I must go back. No, she did not understand. She was only the country silence and the blessed dark, the bright stream, the wind, the hills, the cool house, all that was hers and her. She could not understand. But she took him in, the stranger in the rainy night, who would destroy her. She sat beside him and said softly,
I think it's worth it, Stefan. It's worthwhile.
It is. We'll borrow, we'll beg, we'll steal, we'll filch. I'll be a great scientist, you know. I'll create life in a test tube. After a squalid early career, Fabre rose to sudden prominence. We'll go to meetings in Vienna, in Paris. The hell with life in a test tube. I'll do better than that. I'll get you pregnant within 5 minutes. Oh, you beauty. Laugh, do you? I'll show you, you filly. You little trout. Oh, you darling.
There under the windows of the house, and under the mountains still in sunlight, while the boys shouted playing tennis up beside the house, she lay soft, fair, heavy in his arms under his weight, absolutely pure, flesh and spirit, one pure will, to let him come in, let him come in. not now, not here. His will was mixed and obdurate. He rolled away and lay face up in the grass, a black flicker in his eyes, looking at the sky. She sat with her hand on his hand. Peace had never left her. When she sat up, she looked at him as she had looked at Bendika's baby, steadily, with pondering recognition. She had no praise for him, no reservation, no judgment. Here he is. This is he.
"It'll be meager, Bruna, meager and unprofitable."
"I expect so," she said, watching him.
He stood up and brushed grass off his trousers.
"I love Bruna,"
he shouted, lifting his hand. And from the sunlit slopes across the river marshes where dusk was rising came a vague, short sound. Not her name, not his voice.
"You see,"
he said, standing over her, smiling.
"Echoes, even. Get up, the sun's going. Do you want me to get pneumonia again?"
She reached out her hand. He took it and pulled her up to him.
"I'll be very loyal, Bruna,"
he said. He was a small man, and when they stood together, she did not look up to him, but straight at him at eye level.
"That's what I have to give," he said. "That's all I have to give. You may get sick of it, you know."
Her eyes, gray-brown or gray, unclear, watched him steadily. In silence he raised his hand to touch for a moment, with reserve and tenderness, her fair, parted hair. They went back up to the house, past the tennis court where Kazimir on one side of the net and the two boys on the other swung, missed, leapt, and shouted. Under the oaks, Brett sat practicing a guitar tune.
"What language is that one?"
Bruna asked, standing light in the shadow, utterly happy. Brett cocked his head to answer, his misshapen right hand lying across the strings.
"Greek. I got it from a book. It means, 'Oh, young lovers who pass beneath my window, can't you see it's raining?'"
She laughed aloud, standing by Stefan, who had turned to watch the three run and poise on the tennis court in rising shadow, the ball soar up from moment to moment into the level gold light. He walked into Prevna next day to buy their tickets with Kazimir, who wanted to see the weekly market there. Kazimir took joy in markets, fairs, auctions, the noise of people getting and selling, the barrows of white and purple turnips, racks of old shoes, mounds of print cotton, stacks of blue-coated cheese, the smell of onions, fresh lavender, sweat, dust. The road that had been long the night they came was brief in the warm morning.
"Still looking for that get-em-out-alive fellow, Brett says," said Kazimir.
Tall, frail, calm, he moseyed along beside his friend, his bare head bright in the sunlight.
"Bruna and I want to get married," Stefan said.
"You do?"
"Yes."
Kazimir hesitated a moment in his long-legged amble, went on, hands in his pockets. Slowly, on his face, appeared a smile.
"Do you really?"
"Yes."
Kazimir stopped, took his right hand out of his pocket, shook Stefan's.
"Good work," he said. "Well done."
He was blushing a little.
"Now that's something real," he said,
going on, hands in his pockets. Stefan glanced at his long, quiet young face.
"That's absolute," Kazimir said. "That's real."
After a while, he said,
"That beats Schubert."
"Main problem is finding a place to live, of course. But if I can borrow something to get started on, Metor still wants me for that project. We'd like to do it straight off. If it's all right with your parents, of course."
Kazimir listened fascinated to these chances and circumstances confirming the central fact, just as he watched fascinated the buyers and sellers, shoes and turnips, racks and carts of a market fair that confirmed men's need of food and of communion.
"It'll work out," he said. "You'll find a place."
"I expect so," said Stefan, never doubting it.
He picked up a rock, tossed it up and caught it, hurled it white through sunlight far into the furrows to their left.
"If you knew how happy I am, Kazimir."
His friend answered, "I have some notion. Here, shake hands again." They stopped again to shake hands.
Move in with us, eh, Kazi?
All right. Get me a truckle bed. They were coming into town. A khaki-colored truck crawled down Prevnez main street between fly-blown shops, old houses painted with garlands long faded. Over the roofs rose high yellow hills. Under lindens, the market square was dusty and sun-dappled. A few racks, a few stands and carts, a noseless man selling sugar candy, three dogs cringingly, unwearingly following a white bitch, old women in black shawls, old men in black vests, the lanky keeper of the post-telephone bar leaning in his doorway and spitting, two fat men dickering in a mumble over a pack of cigarettes.
"Used to be more to it," Kazimir said. "When I was a kid here, lots of cheese from Portacheca, vegetables, mounds of 'em. Everybody turned out for it."
They wandered between the stalls, content, aware of brotherhood. Stefan wanted to buy Bruna something, anything, a scarf. There were buttonless mud-colored overalls, cracked shoes.
"Buy her a cabbage," Kazimir said, and Stefan bought a large red cabbage.
They went into the post-telephone bar to buy their tickets to Eisenar.
"Two on the southwest to Eisenar, Mr. Prospayets."
"Back to work, eh?"
"Right."
Three men came up to the counter, two on Kazimir's side, one on Stefan's. They handed over.
"Fabre Stefan, domicile 136 Tome Street, Krosnoy, student, MR64100282A. Aujeska Kazimir, domicile 4 Sorden Street, Krosnoy, student, MR80104944A. Business in Eisenar?"
"Catching the train to Krosnoy."
The men returned to a table.
"In here all day, past 10 days, the innkeeper said in a thready mumble. "Kills my business. I need another 100 kroner, Mr. Kazimir. Trying to shortchange me?"
Two of the men, one thick-set, the other slim and wearing an army gun belt under his jacket, were by them again. The smiling innkeeper went blank like a television set, clicked off. He watched the agents go through the young men's pockets and feel up and down their bodies. When they had gone back to the table, he handed Kazimir his change, silent. They went out in silence. Kazimir stopped and stood looking at the golden lindens, the golden light dappling dust where three dogs still trotted abased and eager after the white bitch. A fat housewife laughed with an old cackling man. Two boys dodged yelling among the carts. A donkey hung his gray head and twitched one ear.
"Oh well," Stefan said. Kazimir said nothing. "I've butted off," Stefan said. "Come on, Kazi."
They set off slowly.
"Right,"
Kazimir said, straightening up a little.
"It's not relevant, you know," said Stefan. "Is the innkeeper really named Prospayets?"
"Evander Prospayets. Has a brother runs the winery here. Belisarius Prospayets."
Stefan grinned. Kazimir smiled a little vaguely. They were at the edge of the marketplace, about to cross the street.
"Damn, I forgot my cabbage in the bar," Stefan said, turning, and saw some men running across the marketplace between the carts and stalls.
There was a loud clapping noise. Kazimir grabbed at Stefan's shoulder for some reason, but missed, and stood there with his arms spread out, making a coughing, retching sound in his throat. His arms jerked wider, and he fell down, backwards, and lay at Stefan's feet, his eyes open, his mouth open, and full of blood. Stefan stood there. He looked around. He dropped on his knees by Kazimir, who did not look at him. Then he was pulled up and held by the arm. There were men around him, and one of them was waving something, a paper, saying loudly,
"This is him, the traitor. This is what happens to traitors. These are his forged papers. This is him."
Stefan wanted to get to Kazimir, but was held back. He saw men's backs, a dog, a woman's red staring face in the background under golden trees. He thought they were helping him to stand, for his knees had given under him. But as they forced him to turn and walk, he tried to pull free, crying out, "Kazimir!" He was lying on his face on a bed,
which was not the bed in the high-windowed room in the Aujeskar house. He knew it was not, but kept thinking it was, hearing the boys calling down on the tennis court. Then, understanding that it was his room in Krasnoy and his roommates were asleep, he lay still for a long time, despite a fierce headache. Finally, he sat up and looked around at the pine plank walls, the grating in the door, the stone floor with cigarette butts and dried urine on it. The guard who brought his breakfast was the thick-set agent from the post-telephone bar and did not speak. There were pine splinters in the quicks of his nails on both his hands. He spent a long time getting them out. Note: the practice of driving wooden splinters under fingernails is a common form of torture, found in accounts of medieval interrogations, records of the Spanish Inquisition, and eyewitness stories from a number of 20th century conflicts. End note. On the third day, a different guard came, a fat, dark-jowled fellow reeking of sweat and onions like the market under the lindens.
"What town am I in?"
"Brevna."
The guard locked the door, offered a cigarette through the grating, held a lighted match through.
"Is my friend dead? Why did they shoot him?"
"Man they wanted got away," said the guard. "Need anything in there? You'll be out tomorrow."
"Did they kill him?"
The guard grunted yes and went off. After a while, a half-full pack of cigarettes and a box of matches dropped in through the grating near Stefan's feet, where he sat on the cot. He was released next day, seeing no one but the dark-jowled guard who led him to the door of the village lockup. He stood on the main street of Prevne, half a block down from the marketplace. Sunset was over. It was cold, the sky clear and dark above the lindens, the roofs, the hills. His ticket to Eisenar was still in his pocket. He walked slowly and carefully to the marketplace and across it, under dark trees, to the post-telephone bar. No bus was waiting. He had no idea when they ran. He went in and sat down, hunched over, shaking with cold, at one of the three tables. Presently, the owner came out from a back room.
"When's the next bus?"
He could not think of the man's name. Prospets, Priespets, something like that.
"Eisenar, 8:20 in the morning," the man said.
"To Portacheca?"
Stefan asked after a pause.
"Local to Portacheca at 10.
"Tonight?"
10 tonight.
"Can you change this for a ticket to Portacheca?"
He held out his ticket for Eisenar. The man took it and, after a moment, said,
"Wait, I'll see."
He went off again to the back. Stefan got change ready for a cup of coffee and sat hunched over. It was 7:10 by the white-faced alarm clock at the bar. At 7:30, when the big townsman came in for a beer, he moved as far back as he could by the pool table and sat there facing the wall, only glancing round quickly now and then to check the time on the alarm clock. He was still shaking, and so cold that after a while he put his head down on his arms and shut his eyes. Bruna said,
"Stefan."
She had sat down at the table with him. Her hair looked pale as cotton round her face, his head still hunched forward, his arms on the table. He looked at her, and then looked down.
"Mr. Prospets telephoned us. Where were you going?"
He did not answer.
"Did they tell you to get out of town?"
He shook his head.
"They just let you go? Come on. I brought your coat. Here. You must be cold. Come on home."
She rose, and at this, he sat up. He took his coat from her and said,
"No, I can't."
"Why not?"
"Dangerous for you. Can't face it anyway."
"Can't face us? Come on. I want to get out of here. We're driving back to Krasnoy tomorrow. We were waiting for you. Come on, Stefan."
He got up and followed her out. It was night now. They set off across the street and up the country road, Bruna holding a flashlight beamed before them. She took his arm. They walked in silence. Around them were dark fields, stars.
"Do you know what they did with—"
"They took him off in the truck, we were told."
"I don't. when everybody in the town knew who he was...
He felt her shrug. They kept walking. The road was long again, as when he and Kazimir had walked it the first time without light. They came to the hill where the lights had appeared, the laughter and calling all round them in the rain.
"Come faster, Stefan,"
the girl beside him said timidly.
"You're cold."
He had to stop soon, and breaking away from her, went blind to the roadside seeking anything, a fence post or tree, anything to lean against till he could stop crying. But there was nothing. He stood there in the darkness, and she stood near him. At last he turned, and they went on together. Rocks and weeds showed white in the ragged circle of light from her flashlight. As they crossed the hill crest, she said with the same timidity and stubbornness,
"I told Mother we want to marry. When we heard they had you in jail here, I told her. Not Father, yet. This was what he couldn't stand. He can't take it. But Mother's all right. And so I told her. I'd like to be married quite soon, if you would, Stefan."
He walked beside her, silent.
"Right," he said finally. "No good letting go, is there?"
The lights of the house below them were yellow through the trees. Above them, stars and a few thin clouds drifted through the sky.
"No good at all."
1962.